Knock, knock. Who's there? Amelia's Weekly Fish Fry. Hey, come on. I had to do it at least once, right? Welcome, everyone, to this here engineering podcast brought to you by EEJournal.com. I'm Amelia Dalton, your hostess, and we're running the gamut of EE this week. Now, first, I've got a little something on my mind, and no, it has nothing to do with zombie dragons right now. So I love producing this podcast every week, and heck, maybe you love listening to it as well. Well, if you're a longtime listener, occasional checker-inner, or even if this is your first time, welcome. I'd love to hear your voices. So please rate this podcast on iTunes. Give me your feedback. The more reviews, the bigger the audience, the bigger the budget. Okay, maybe not that last one. So please take a second to give me your review on iTunes. My team and I would be very glad you did. As you may already know, here on Fish Fry, we like to support the underdogs, encourage basement innovation. But seriously, you guys, open a window occasionally. That blue smoke is, rough. We send a team to Maker Faire every year, and perfectly along those lines is this week's news you may have missed. Maker Edition, starring Italian maker Michel Lizit. Now, we have talked about 3D printing a whole bunch of times, including one of my all-time favorite episodes just last week about 3D printed shark monitoring devices. So cool. But Michel Lizit is taking 3D printing to a whole new level. For about $12 and change, or 10 euros, this 18-year-old maker extraordinaire from Udine, Italy, created his own 3D printer. Yeah, with a print resolution of 33 microns on both axes, I might add. By throwing together parts from, get this, three old inkjet printers, a flatbed scanner with the addition of a hot-end extruder, an ATmega 328 processing brain, a motor driver, three driver boards, and a high current transistor. All totaling, yep, about $12. Kind of nuts, right? Now, the extruder housing was 3D printed using a standard desktop machine, but instead of a hobbed bolt, he used the paper loading mechanism from one of the inkjet printers. He also used a plastic plate from the scanner, which is topped by cardboard packaging from Amazon. And right now, cardboard biscuit boxes are holding this thing up. Okay, he does promise to make a solid metal frame in the future, since apparently the cardboard is starting to affect the precision of the machine. Yeah, I can guess. Okay, so three big keys to this inkjet plus scanner with a couple other things equals 3D printer equation. Number one, those linear encoders from the inkjet printers. That's some really great reuse of hardware, if you ask me. Number two, those DC motors. Instead of step motors, they'll consume way less power. And three, Michel Lizet's firmware, which he is now making open source as well. Awesome. If you want to see Mr. Lizet's printer in action, I've included a link below the player on this week's Fish Frying page on EEJournal.com. Okay, let's head into a completely different direction. Portable stimulus. The next frontier of functional verification. Let me bring in Adnan Hamid, CEO of Brekker, who joins us to discuss the controversy around portable stimulus representation models, the future of portable stimulus, move over UVM, maybe it's time for something new, and why we may be just scratching the surface of what portable stimulus can be. Let's go. My guest today is Adnan Hamid from Brekker. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having us, Amelia.
Okay, so first off, for my audience who may not know, what is Brekker all about?
Brekker recently got named the granddaddy of portable stimulus. So Brekker is the first company that went out to solve the problem that now is called portable stimulus. And we've been providing commercial tools in this area for the last 10 years. The idea is to be able to give people a way to write highly abstracted verification models from which they can generate tests either for UVM or to generate so-called software-driven tests, which are C tests that'll run on an embedded processor.
All right, so let's talk about this portable stimulus specification. Now, Accelera introduced the early adopter release from the portable stimulus working group, but tell my audience more about this portable stimulus specification.
Indeed, the early adopter release of the draft went out just before DAC, and it was a result of a lot of work from a lot of people. The portable stimulus working group was formed by Accelera roughly 2 years ago. And for the first year, we spent our time collecting requirements, talking to all the interested users, understanding what problems they wanted to solve. As we were going through this process, I realized that Brecker understood how to solve these problems far better than any of the users or any of the EDA vendors either, simply because we had been solving this problem for a long time. Not that we're smarter, we just had the experience. After we collected requirements, we started to get into solutions, and there were certain solutions provided by the big EDA vendors, but the users understood what Brecker had been doing, and they really pulled us into the standard and said, hey, Adnan, can you please put forward your ideas? We really need them in portable stimulus. And it is the users who have enabled a little company like Brecker to really drive that standard. So the standard that's come out, about half of that is written by us. And there's a controversy in there as well. We've come up with two different ways of representing portable stimulus models. There's one is a new language called the so-called DSL, which is a fully declarative language. And then there's also a C++ variant in it for people who are more used to writing software models. We'll be able to take advantage of. So it's an exciting development, and certainly for all the listeners on this podcast, you should go look at it. You should come back to the committee, tell us what you think, give us your feedback, because we're very much looking for this.
Excellent. Now, you guys have been advocating a graph-based approach to chip design verification and been selling this product since 2008. So what gave you the idea of using graphs specifically for verification?
I started my career back in 1992 at AMD. The first thing my employer wanted me to do was to write a pile of test cases for them. I thought that was a pretty boring task. It turned out when I was in college before that, I had done some work on machine problem solving. So today we are talking about machine learning, which is looking at a bunch of data and trying to analyze something about it. Machine problem solving says we're going to provide a computer with something that tells it how to solve a problem and it'll find various solutions. And when it came to writing these test cases that my employer wanted, I realized that the traditional constrained random approaches like UVM, which actually frankly wasn't available then, wasn't going to be enough. And what I wanted to do was to bring the power of machine problem solving to generation of test cases. Well, it turns out when you look at machine problem solving, they talk about rule-based systems, which are essentially graph-based systems. So graphs are a very powerful way to capture what it is you want to do. And the basic intuition behind a graph is you start with what it is you want to check, and you build a graph that describes to a machine what are all the ways you can get to that result. So the tool begins with picking something it wants to check, solves for a test case that should give him that behavior, drives the test case into the design, and sees whether we got the behavior we want. So this turned out to be a very compact and very powerful way to express verification intent. And it transpired that as this whole standards body came about, we were all saying, hey, this has got to be a graph-based model. So we were very much on the forefront of this.
Now, Brecker is demonstrating its compliant implementation of the earlier adopter release, which we talked about earlier. What has been the reaction from people around who have seen the Brecker demo?
So we've already covered the fact that Brecker's been solving this problem for a long time.
Right.
So really this moving across to the new standard has not been a big change for us. It's a small front-end change. It's our back-end technology is all solid, continues to work. So really, for people who are looking at a technology, have seen the old stuff, looking at the new stuff, it's not really that different. We were able to get the standard to come out where really there was nothing introduced in the standards conversation that we didn't already have. Not going the other way. There are many things we think needs to be in the standard that aren't there, but that's a different point. As in, there's much more needed for a full solution. So it's been exciting. People have very much enjoyed seeing how we adopted the standard, and it's been an easy transition.
All right, so what's next for Brecker and the portable stimulus specification?
The domain of portable stimulus, it is the next frontier of functional verification. We've done UVM for 15 years. I think we're all a little bit tired of it. time for something new. It is a higher level of abstraction, and it is one of those things that has legs. There are many directions for it to go. We are just scratching the surface of what portable stimulus could be. There's the direction of trying to reuse from UVM unit benches to system benches. There's the direction of trying to go from virtual prototypes to simulation to emulation to FPGA prototypes to post-silicon. There's the direction of moving up into software. There's just a lot of work to be done. Adoption of this technology, never easy for the users. And we are following the path of Jasper in the sense of coming up with this idea of apps on top of this technology, turnkey solutions that people can deploy right away. One very popular app that we've had in the market for a couple of years is our cache coherency app. As people are building ARM-based systems, coherency has become a big problem. As we deployed that, we started to get a lot of requests to put in ARM-specific features into our coherency app, so that's gotten carved into our ARMv8 app, which we introduced at DAC today. And then finally, power management is a perennial problem, right? We want to worry about how to measure our power, but simply the logic that deals with powering on, powering off, go to low power state, high power state, is very complex, and we have turned out an app designed to go verify that specifically. Lots of new exciting things happening. I think the standard is really helping us, because there's always been a bit of a worry that, Brecker, we really like your ideas, but you're the only guys doing this. And now with the standard, that problem is eliminated as well. So we're having a very exciting time.
Excellent. Well, I think that's all I have time for today. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Amelia.
Keeping up with our run on the gamut of EE, let's talk about choosing the right capacitor for your next SSD holdup application, which apparently doesn't include bank tellers and ski masks. Weird. We all know that finding the cap that can give you just the right amount of juice for your system to survive power outages without data loss is a tricky business. In a recent episode of Chalk Talk entitled Capacitors for Enterprise SSD, I sit down with James Lewis of Chemet and chat about the advantages and disadvantages of various capacitor choices for SSD holdup. The intro for this one is pretty funny. And you can check out this episode of Chalk Talk by clicking the link below the player on this week's fish frying page on eejournal.com. You can also check out the Chalk Talk section of eejournal.com or head on over to YouTube, keyword eejournal. Hey, have you checked out EE Journal on social media yet? Well, you should. You can find us at facebook.com/EEJournal. If you're into Twitter, you can monitor our tweets at EEJournalTFM. And hey, if LinkedIn is more your thing, well, sure, you can follow us on LinkedIn as well. And we have that YouTube channel I mentioned earlier, keyword EEJournal. It is chock full of all kinds of techie videos, including our very popular Chalk Talk webcast series. Also, by clicking the links below the player on this week's Fish Fryin' page, you can grab our Fish Fryin' RSS feed or subscribe to Fish Fry via the iTunes Store. And remember, if you want any further information about the stories covered in today's show, just head on over to eejournal.com and look for this week's Fish Fryin' page. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. If you know of any cool new technology, even if your company makes it, that's totally okay. Any fun EE conference coming up that I absolutely should attend, or even the best geeky hotspot in your city, shoot me a line at amelia@eejournal.com or post a comment on our forums on EE Journal. For the week of September 1st, 2017, I'm Amelia Dalton, and you've been fried.